is the promise of the American dream withering away. Addiction, joblessness, family disruption, violence, and trauma plague rural towns across the country. In the new book, We're Still Here, Pain and Politics in the Heart of America, author Jennifer Silva proposes that the key to understanding the puzzle of working class politics is to understand how the decline of the American dream is lived and felt. Sociologist Jennifer Silva draws on interviews of over 100 residents in the declining coal region of Pennsylvania conducted in the years leading up to the 2016 presidential election. She looked to connect people's accounts of emotional, existential, and physical pain to their political stances. The name of the book is We're Still Here, Pain and Politics and the Heart of America. Jennifer Silva is assistant professor at the Paul O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University in Bloomington, and it's a pleasure to welcome Jennifer Silva to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Very nice to have you on the program. This book draws on interviews of over 100 residents in a declining coal region of Pennsylvania. You conducted these interviews in the years leading up to the 2016 presidential election. What brought you to want to do this?
When I wrote my first book, which was called Coming Up Short, I actually interviewed young adults about their struggles to grow up today. And one of the most interesting findings was that young adults had given up on social institutions and given up on this larger sense of belonging and instead thought about the world in a very isolated way. So they thought that they were responsible for their own fates and they didn't want to depend on anyone else and they didn't trust anyone. And so I thought, oh, that would be really interesting if I went and talked to, you know, working class people who are struggling, especially in the aftermath of the recession, and ask them about how they understood politics and whether this sense of distrust and isolation was actually translating into political ideas and behavior.
It seems when the working people of an area such as rural Pennsylvania or West Virginia, the focus is on white workers. That was not your focus.
You know, I'll be honest, I started the book focused on white working class people and especially men. And I was very surprised to see that central Pennsylvania was becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. So there was a population of Black and Hispanic people coming to central Pennsylvania from larger cities like D.C. and New York and Baltimore. And we're actually there because it seemed safer and more affordable to rent or buy a house. And there seemed to be more jobs. And so I actually, instead of writing a book about the white working class left behind, I actually was able to write more about interactions and flux in rural America between different groups of people.
Tell us about the geography of why you chose this particular place in Pennsylvania.
So I call this area Colebrook. It's actually a mixture of two small towns in central Pennsylvania. And what's interesting about it was it used to be where the anthracite coal mining industry was very strong. There were many, many coal jobs. It supported a population of almost 1 million people. It was known for being very high in solidarity, so churches and social clubs and political parties were very strong, and also a place that was very democratic. So the miners tended to have a pretty strong sense of class solidarity and were able to unionize and sort of fight against the coal companies. And what was interesting to me was to see what had happened after the coal jobs went away, and many of the residents moved away if they could. And what's left behind sort of feels like a place where there's more tattoo parlors and vape shops and less jobs and things to do. And the people there sort of feel like they've, you know, been left behind. And I thought that would be a really interesting study to see what happens to these people who have this history that's very vibrant and all about class struggle, what's happening to them now.
Left behind, they feel forgotten.
They do. They do feel forgotten, especially by politicians and by the government.
So in the lead up to the 2016 election, give us an idea of what was being said to them and how they were reacting to that.
So what was very interesting to me was even in 2015, when I started interviewing, it was actually very difficult for me to find working class people. So these are people who don't have a college degree. They didn't identify with a political party and actually often would laugh at me that because I believed that my vote mattered or I believed that democracy was working. And so I actually ended up hearing people say that, you know, democracy has been rigged in favor of the wealthy. They believed that politicians were basically working for corporations and no one cared about their best interest. So what was interesting was that, you know, the two candidates who seemed like outsiders, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, seemed like the only possibility. But for, you know, I interviewed over 100 people and, you know, 2/3 of those didn't even think voting mattered. One person told me, when it comes to voting, I don't think a president will change anything. The government lies to us every day. I think politicians and government are the biggest liars in the world.
So do you think when it came down to it, about only a third of those people that you talked to actually voted?
Yes, I think that's right. I actually went to this area on the day of the election wearing my I voted sticker, and someone told me I should probably take it off because it was, you know, ridiculous and made me look dumb to think that my vote would actually change things.
Were those voters, were those people being courted?
You know, I don't think they were very connected to political organizations or actually any social institutions. They were very much focused on their own lives, but they weren't really wrapped up in any kinds of like churches or clubs or anywhere where they would be seen as like a group that would get a group message. So instead, I found that people would be on their smartphones or on Facebook, and that was where they would learn about politics.
The one of the interesting things that you have a chapter in the book called "The Coal Miner's Granddaughter," and you started that off by how many of these women think of themselves, which is not in very positive terms.
That's right. The women in the book who I interviewed, you know, what they wanted to talk about was not so much politics when I would interview them for an hour or two, but they wanted to talk about family life. So they would talk about how in their histories, you know, the coal mining jobs went away and they saw an increase in alcoholism and domestic violence in the family. And they were kind of living in these lives that were traumatic, you know, violence and poverty. And, you know, they would talk about how they would rely on food and cigarettes and drugs to deal with their pain. And they really didn't see politics as a way to improve their lives, because one woman said to me, I've been betrayed so many times in my life, starting in my own family, but also in other places, that it seems almost dangerous to rely on politicians to help me. And I have to, you know, make the most of my life and fix my life on my own.
You get the sense, but I'm interested in your perspective of, are they looking for a way out?
That's a great question. I think that if they're looking for a way out, it's not one that's through politics, because they've given up on politics, and it's really about fixing their lives on their own. And, you know, some of them do believe that there's no hope. I mean, some people told me that America had become a wasteland and, you know, there was no hope left. And the only hope that people really had was in terms of being able to try to give their children a better life, but they didn't think anyone would help them do that except for themselves.
When you look at this idea, and you write about it in the book, there's a chapter entitled In Search of Redemption. You are looking at, later on you look at the lives of Black and Latino women, but in this particular chapter you focus on Black and Latino men. What kind of redemption were they looking for?
This was a very interesting finding where I started to talk to Black and Latino men, and many of them had left behind lives where they grew up in neighborhoods that had a lot of violence and poverty. They had sometimes criminal records where they felt like they had been, targeted by the police. And some of them said they had made bad choices in terms of drugs and crime. And so one of the things they were doing was they were trying to start over. And they said, you know, you can't outrun trouble in the city. But if I move here and I can rent a house for $400 a month and I can maybe find a job in a warehouse, my kids can play outside. I don't have to worry about them being shot. So it was sort of a way to start over. And for them, you know, many of the white people saw the town kind of as being left behind as this wasteland. But for the racial and ethnic minorities, it actually seemed like a fresh start.
A lot of this book is, I mean, it's very sad, right? It's melancholy and blue. And I think that comes through, especially with the young people that you talk to.
It is a melancholy book. I always try to find kind of places of hope, but when people sit down and want to talk to me, the stories they tell are about, you know, struggling every single day. They do live in poverty. They don't see a lot of hope in terms of, you know, getting better educated and finding better jobs. When I talk to them, they're sometimes trying to find, you know, an empty bed in drug and alcohol rehab for a family member, or, you know, crying because their daughter wants a fish tank for Christmas and their lights have been shut off and they can't figure out how to afford it. And so it is sort of a bleak story, and, you know, much more in some ways, like I wanted to write about voting, but I end up writing about addiction and joblessness and racism and violence and trying to understand what it's like to be, you know, poor and working class in America today.
Realizing that this is some 4 years removed from when you started this, we can only assume and extrapolate that these problems for many of these individuals have gotten worse, especially when you look at the numbers that we see in regards to drug deaths, unemployment, ..
I think that's probably true, and I would imagine that their sense of distrust of systems and social institutions is probably still very strong.
So you talk about the forgotten and you talk about these dead communities, and I'm interested in what our takeaway should be. What do you believe our takeaway should be in hearing and reading this story of what is to be done for the people in not just this one or two communities in the state of Pennsylvania, but communities like this throughout the country?
I think that we can learn a lot from working class Americans. One of the biggest surprises for me in my research was how critical of economic injustice the people I spoke to were, and how critical they were of, for example, you know, politicians who seemed to be, you know, working for corporations more than they were for everyday people. And so I would say there actually is kind of some hope where they are critical and they do kind of have a vision of what justice might look like. The problem, of course, is having them become trustful enough to actually organize or mobilize. And to me, that seems like it's going to take a lot of on-the-ground grassroots efforts aimed at building trust.
Should there be optimism?
You know, I think so. I think, you know, sometimes I would be, for example, sitting in a, you know, addiction support group for families, and I would see people trying to help each other and trying to share information about how to get medication or how to get housing. And I mean, people did seem to be able to come together to help each other solve problems. So it's sort of like maybe we can try to focus on that aspect and think about how we could build on that.
I think there are many people who will read this and assume that the individuals that you write about in this book are Trump voters.
I think that that's often the assumption. I mean, I went in thinking that would be the case too, and I was actually surprised when, you know, I did have some Trump voters, but for them it was sort of like, well, maybe this, you know, billionaire who, you know, isn't part of this really corrupt political system, maybe we have a shot, maybe he can help us. But for the most part, it was more about alienation and disengagement and just lack, you know, this idea that America had become this con job, whether it's education or the military or, you know, any institution, the government, where that was the sense more than believing a candidate could help them.
And that's the federal government, that's the state government, that's the local government.
That's right. I think, you know, the federal government for sure, and then in the state government, you know, that's also the case too, because many of them would actually witness corruption at the local level.
Right. The name of the book is We're Still Here, Pain and Politics in the Heart of America. Jennifer Silva, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.